Everybody in, nobody out. Everybody in, nobody out. Everybody in, nobody out.
From Baltimore, this is UWEPR, United Workers and Poverty Radio.
On April 8, 2014, renowned economist Gar Alpovitz spoke on the need for universal health care at the annual meeting of Healthcare Now Maryland. The following audio was recorded and edited by the United Workers media team.
What I genuinely come to do is listen as much as I can. And now they make me talk in order to get to listen, but you don't learn much by sitting in your study unless you can talk to folks. So I am impressed with what you're doing, and Sergio's laying out of the issues seemed to me right on target, very impressive. And the notion of actually the last speaker saying it's time to, we're not going to get there by just going to the legislature, we're going to have to build a movement. That seems pretty clear to me, and also as a historian, it seems to me that when organizations and groups reach that point, it is a critical moment in the development of political movements. So let me say that again. I come at things as a historian and a political economist, so you have to forgive me. I think in kind of long space and how do things actually get going. And one of the crucial steps is when folks say, it isn't going to work that way anymore unless we do something new and different and get out there and change the system in a different way. Now, I ran House and Senate staffs at one point. I come out of the inside of the Democratic Party. And I know what the lobbying game is, and that's why I left that world. You can only do so much. Now, that doesn't mean you can't do anything. Jamie Raskin does a lot within that system, and thank God we've got folks like that. But unless there is an outside developmental process that people understand what they're doing is building a political movement that is serious, there will not be change. And what I hear in this room and what I've heard in the discussion so far, all of the folks who've spoken so far, and I know Margaret is deeply into this, and Kevin, the issue is now before us in a different way. So that's kind of the first thing I want to say. The second thing I want to say, which is odd, is that I assume you all understand that we don't have any economic problems in the United States. No, I mean it. This is the wealthiest economy in the history of the world. If you were to divide the gross national product today by all the citizens, every family of four today would have $200,000 a year. We don't have an economic problem. We have a political problem managing the most powerful economic system in the history of the world. And that means that what we do politically is at stake, not what the economists tell you about what has to be done for some arcane economic theory that I wear the other hat as an economist, that some economist cooked up to tell you why you can't do what you want to do. If we build the movement to achieve what is necessary, then we can do what we want to do because this is a very, very, very wealthy system that could provide wonderful lives for all of its citizens easily. So that's a second matter of perspective that I sort of bring to, at least when I think about these things. The third thing I want to say is that what I've been talking around the country a lot lately with, you know, traveling around with this book, kind of, you get into a book tour, but book tours, again, is when you can hear different things going on that you don't hear in your study. There's a conference coming up that Kevin was mentioning, and the conference is going to be, when is it the date?
May
16th and 17th here. There is a bubbling up of what is called the new economy movement, for lack of a better term. And it's building in different ways in different parts of the country, and in my view, it is a major step forward, breaking from if we only elected a liberal Democrat. It's beginning to say, and I'm for electing as many liberal Democrats as we can. It's better than the alternative. But unless we can build up a power base that begins actually practically, and I really mean this, practically talking about changing the system of power in the United States, we will continue to lose. Now, That's a really weird thing to think about, because most people do not actually test this by their own reaction. Most people don't actually think they can change the system. Test it. Do you believe that? Historically, it's a very hard thing for most people to think that actually what has to happen is we need to change the political economic system. And that is such a challenging and strange idea to most people that they forget that historically systems come and go all the time. The Berlin Wall drops, South Africa changes all of a sudden. The one I like best, because it brings it right home, the French had a revolution, but the one I like best is the bunch of farmers and small merchants in the United States took on the biggest, most powerful empire in the world, and they won. It is a possibility throughout Latin America. There are explosions all over the world. Things are happening. And it is a normal process rather than an unnormal process when the power relationships are so strong. Now, I'm not a utopian. I don't think this happens all the time, and I don't think it happens easily. But it is also true that when systems continue to fail, when pain grows, when more and more people are disillusioned, when they reach the point, very interesting thing was said here, when they reach the point when you know that going door to door to talk to the legislatures, lobbying isn't going to do it, that you've got to get out and organize. Those are steps in the kind of slow development of consciousness that are big deals, not small deals. So yes, hey, contributions for that, that's really important, organizing. Yes, do that. But that's a big step. What's happening around the country is, to me, which is in part and parcel of what I think your movement is about and my movement is about, is something about capital and ownership. Let me say something strange about that. A public single-payer health system is a socialized public insurance company. That's what it is. It's a government-owned insurance company. I mean, I think we have to go beyond single-payer, and probably a lot of people don't, but that's the big, big major step. So what does that mean? It means that instead of the insurance companies owning the insurance company, the public owns it. That's what single-payer is. We don't quite formulate it that way. We talk about single-payer, but once you formulate it that way, you begin thinking about, oh, it's about democracy, democratic ownership of a company. That's a strange way of thinking about it. It is a socialized system, if you like. But nonetheless, what it is who gets to own the system gets to control it. And in the case of single payer, that's what you're talking about. And it is the biggest system in the United States that over the next decades has the possibility of being transformed away from the current power sources, the private insurance companies, the private pharmaceutical companies, the private hospital system, to a different system, piecemeal, I think, state by state, by agonizing state by state, but also transforming a major sector in the economy to democratic ownership and control. Now, that's a hard thing to do. And what drives that is pain, and then awareness, and then action, and then thought and strategy. What is really interesting is, if you look at the single payer process around the country, what 22 states are now considering moving in the way that Vermont has moved, slowly, agonizingly, in difficult ways, there are different parts of the economy where precisely the same thing is happening, and alliances are beginning to be thought about around the simple idea of who gets to own this. Is it in the interest of the public, or is it in the interest of the corporations? And not simply trying to regulate the corporations. There is some of my heroes on this subject, you're going to laugh when I say it, are the conservative economists at the University of Chicago who taught Milton Friedman, the great conservative economist, his economics. Huh? That doesn't sound right, does it? Well, the conservative economists in the early Chicago School of Economics understood exactly what we're talking about here. The reason is they actually believed genuinely in a free market economic system where there was genuine competition. And they saw the big corporations as rigging the system against what they genuinely believed in. And some of them, many of them, had great integrity, coming from a different part of the political spectrum from me, but they had integrity about their ideas, and they understood that the big corporations, and we're now talking about insurance companies and pharmaceuticals and hospital chains in this country, rigged the system by using political power. And if you tried to regulate them, watch this, is a conservative way of doing it, genuine conservative, I'm not talking about phonies, real conservatives, not the guys who just spout rhetoric. If you try to regulate them, these people argue, they will take over the regulators. Yep, that's what happens typically. They do take over the regulators because they've got enough power to do that insidiously. Now, the other alternative is you break them up and you get real competition. But then they regroup, like AT&T and Standard Oil, and they're back at the trough. And these conservatives said, you want to deal with this? These are conservatives, free market economists. There is only one left option left, make them public. That's the only way to get transparency, control, etc. That is a single-payer health system. And the argument, it seems to me, is irrefutable that that direction is the only direction we could possibly go. Aside from the fact, as you know better than I, that if we do that, probably the cost of health care in the United States could be cut in half. We spend twice, as you know better than I do, we spend twice as much as comparable countries with poorer results. The number that sticks in my mind, were we to achieve what's been done elsewhere around the world regularly, the number is $1 trillion a year. The people know that, but that is an extraordinary amount of money that could be saved were we actually living, and with better outcome results, were we living with what, were we doing what other countries do regularly? $1 trillion a year. I urge you to say that to people because they don't really get it when you talk about it. That's the number. Nice round number, at least $1 trillion is in balance and what could be done with that. The thing that began to kind of sketch in this direction is that there's awareness of this basic proposition that somehow we need to change the ownership structure if we're to achieve political outcomes. That has many forms. And as the movement that is developing around the country out of growing pain, out of growing difficulty, continues to deepen, what we're seeing is a whole range of people in different parts of the country reaching a similar conclusion in different ways. So another form of democratizing ownership is not only public, either state or federal ownership of the healthcare system. It is simply worker co-ops or cooperatives, which is another democratic form of ownership. And they are developing all over the country. What are they're developing out of is growing pain, that there is no solution for many, many people. Partly there is a new movement in many parts of the country, I'm going to tell you about several of them that we've seen developing, that also have this characteristic of democratic ownership. Partly it is the new developments, but partly there's an old, old history in the United States that people are drawing on around this idea that people ought to own the production and the distribution in a different way. And that co-op movement, people tend to forget, there are 140 million Americans currently already are members of co-ops in one form or another. That's an old tradition. Some are agricultural, some are food co-ops, some are distributional co-ops, hardware stores, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Some are credit unions. Credit unions are another form of this ownership. Now, I need to say a word about credit unions because there's some really interesting things happening with credit unions. Credit union is a one-person, one-vote bank. That's what it is. It's co-op. You can join your credit union. You got one vote, just like everybody else. People don't quite think of it that way. They don't see it as part and parcel of the movement to democratize ownership. But the credit unions in the United States, and activists have picked up on this in other parts of the country, and they're part of the larger movement concerned with these changes as well. Credit unions in the United States control $1 trillion in capital. That's more than any one of the big five New York big banks. They're also democratic organizations. You can go to the annual board meeting. You can elect the board. nobody ever goes. And if you elect the board, you can allocate the funds to help develop other things. And that's beginning to develop in various parts of the country as people realize that it's not simply a movement that has to be built to try to regulate and not simply to advise the legislatures, would you please vote this way, Mr. or Mrs. No, it means actually transforming who gets to own in a democratic form. That piece is another part of the puzzle. Another thing that's happening, and these are all elements that are pointing in the same converging direction that is suggested by single payer, namely, not simply trying to regulate, but attempting to make public the actual ownership of the system in order to get control of the outcomes. That's what single payer is about. The notion is you can't get there from here unless you own it as a public. That's what you folks are into it. But I think it's a general principle that we're beginning to see in many, many parts of the country. And once you see it as a principle, and also that unlike the traditional discussion of this, where that principle became a horrendous state-owned structure like the Soviet Union, unlike that, there's a very American down-home way of thinking about this that is very decentralized as well. I mean, I'm from Racine, Wisconsin. In Racine, Wisconsin, we've got co-ops. We've got worker-owned co-ops. We've got old credit unions. We've got agricultural co-ops. It's down-home experience of an American kind that begins to suggest a vision. I use the word suggest. Begins to suggest a vision of where we might go that is both very decentralized, but also begins to change where the power really is, which is in ownership. So a vision that's both decentralized and changes the nature of the structure is something a little bit different from what people have been talking about, and yet it draws on the strengths that we're beginning to see in this country, that we have in this country, and we're beginning to see variations of. Let me give you some other examples of what I'm beginning to talk about. It's called the New Economy Movement. I'm sure many of you know about it, but it's bubbling up all over the country, and it's all about this principle that you cannot achieve what you want unless, as you know from the single payer movement, unless you change the ownership of structure. And better do it in a decentralized way if you want to control it, otherwise it gets too centralized. So here's another one. You probably have noticed out in Boulder, Colorado, they took over, the citizens organized a movement to take over the public utility. Why? Because it was pouring pollution into the air, it was creating climate change problems, and they organized enough activity, one by one by one, the same thing Sergio was talking about, and actually won against the utility company. And they're fighting out, they won the first battle by a very small number of votes, and then the second battle by a larger number of votes, and they're still going to have to fight. But they actually understood, you want to do it? If you want to do it, by the way, I'm talking to the person in your chair. If you want to do it, that's how it's done, the way Sergio was discussing it. There is no other way. But what I see, you folks wouldn't be here unless you're actually interested in building a movement rather than talking to the legislators. Now, you've got to talk to legislators as well. But that is the nature of what's happening. And I'll give you another example. We're seeing this all over the country now, and the press doesn't cover this kind of thing. They don't have any interest. They also don't have any reporters anymore. Most newspapers just don't have reporters to cover up what's going on locally. So you really have to dig for it. So I'll give you another one, because we're involved with a very interesting one in Cleveland, Ohio. Now, this is coming out of pain levels, but it's part of the movement that we're all building and have to build. The neighborhood I'm going to talk about is 40,000 people, almost entirely black, unemployment rate 40%. Just let that sink in, 40%. Average income less than $20,000 per family, okay? You got the picture. In the middle of that neighborhood are major institutions, the Cleveland Clinic, world-famous institution, University Hospitals, Case Western Reserve University, right in the middle of that area. Those institutions, you can think about Johns Hopkins while I'm talking about Cleveland, those institutions purchase $3 billion, with a B, not an M, dollars in goods and services a year. Now, let's leave aside the construction, that's much more over here, and leaving aside their salaries, just what they buy. None of it from this area, 40,000 people, 40% unemployment, average family income under 20,000. So a light bulb went on. We're not going to get anywhere lobbying. We're going to set up worker-owned cooperatives, sophisticated worker-owned cooperatives, not little dinky ones. We're going to link them together with a nonprofit corporation so we're not just making some, if we're successful, some workers, quote, rich, not rich, but helping them. We're trying to build a community so that the nonprofit will support the community. The worker-owned cooperatives are sort of hang off of the nonprofit. And then there's a revolving fund so that if you make some money, we're going to set up another one. And also get those hospitals and universities to buy from this structure. So we really begin to build, change who owns, change the participation, and also use the system and have leverage on it to begin moving towards a different systemic design. Let me say it again. The systemic design is eerily in the same direction as a public corporation owning the health system, insurance system. It is a system based on changing ownership, democratizing, making it responsible to the community, and in this case, and we ought to talk about this more, developing a participatory mechanism within the structures of the worker-owned companies or within the structures of the healthcare system as well. That's a whole other dimension that has to be included. So in the Cleveland, so-called the Evergreen model, because they call themselves the Evergreen Cooperatives, the Cleveland models now are underway, and I mentioned they're not just little ones. The largest industrial-scale greenhouse in the United States is one of these co-ops. It produces 3 million heads of lettuce a year. It's that scale. They're not trying, they're trying to change something, not to do, you know, you got to start where you can start, but they're trying to move the ball to a different level, and in that environment, much more difficult than what most of us face, they are raising the level of their aspiration and their sense of who they are to ask, can we change the system? Now, I am suggesting to the person in your chair and in my chair that that is what it's about. It isn't about them. It's not about the insurance companies. And it's not about the health hospitals. It's about whether we actually understand the nature of what it is required to do by us. I'm less interested in them out there than I am in how we actually rise to the level of thinking through what it will take to do what's necessary. That's something we can control. They can control other things. But that's something people like the people in this room, and I suspect most of you are way ahead of me on this stuff, that's our challenge personally, as well as a movement, to actually look squarely at this power system and say, you know, that has to be changed. May take a couple of decades. May take a lot of hard work. Lots of people have done it before. That's what we're going to do. I sometimes tease, you want to play this game? The chips are a couple of decades of your life. That's okay. That's the name of the game. Throw them on the table and, you know, ante up and let's go. No other way to do it. So, but there are models out there that tell you what can be done. I've mentioned Cleveland, I've mentioned Boulder, but by the way, there are 100 cities now have said, hey, you know what's going on over there in Cleveland? Maybe we could do it here. Several of them are well underway. Cincinnati's way underway. Atlanta's underway. Jackson, Mississippi is really interesting. Jacksonville, Florida as well. They said, looked around and said, hey, if you can do it there, maybe we can actually do it here. You guys are doing the same thing. Look at Vermont. Maybe we can do what Vermont does. If people begin to do what is necessary, other people take heart from it and begin to say, we could do that too. Many other things going on around the country that I'm not going to go on and on about this, but we're seeing it because at the university we've been studying it and we've been trying to help build some of it. We helped with the Cleveland model, this Evergreen model. Our team was involved working with this group. But we kind of try to keep an eye on what's going on. So some of you want to follow this, I'll give you a couple of websites. One is called community-wealth.org. Put the dash in because there's one without community, without a dash. And this just surveys, as best we can, many, 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 many kinds of forms of what's going on. Worker co-ops are popping up everywhere. Land trusts are popping up. Now, here's part of the progression. I want to give you a sense of the progression that's also involved in this. It's not only when one person does it or one group does it and other people say, hey, we could do that. That is that. It's also that over time, people get more and more sophisticated about it. So how many folks know what a land trust is? Okay, you draw a circle around 10 blocks in your neighborhood or 15 blocks. Put down a nonprofit corporation or a city corporation. And then when gentrification occurs or tries to occur or begins to occur and the developers come in, instead of that development becoming a high rise and a lot of profit and forcing people out, the nonprofit corporation owns the land. And then you can either allow some small portion of it to gentrify and then tap the profits and subsidize the housing and the rest of it, or you can prevent gentrification and use the development process to support the community. It's another form of changing who gets to own. It's a nonprofit democratic ownership. That idea, another form of this ownership structure that democratizes, 30 years ago, that was regarded as insane. You couldn't, it's socialism, communism, social ownership of land. There are now land trusts all over the country. There were two in 30 years ago, one in Southwest Georgia, one in Vermont. Irvine, California has 5,000 units of housing in this form. Why? Because trying to regulate and trying to whisper in the ears of the legislature doesn't work. What you get then is people shoved out. You get, where did they go? Nobody cares. They're just shoved out. Changing the structure allows you to actually do something different. Changing who owns, making it a public form, in this case a land trust, is also another example of what we're talking about. And we're seeing it all over the country. That's another form that's developing all over the country. So what I'm trying to portray in this kind of ad hoc way, in a kind of casual way, is that there is something happening in the United States that has not happened in a serious way, certainly in my lifetime, and I would suggest to you just possibly has not happened in the United States at all, and that we may actually be living, I think we are living, in one of the most interesting, dangerous, and yet possibility-filled eras of American history. Now, that's a strange thing to say. Who, us? This era? Nothing's changing. It's all, you know, it's really hard. We're not getting very far with the healthcare system. They're powerful. Why I think it is just possibly, we can test this, by the way. You test it by organizing and trying. We can test it. Why I think it is so interesting and potentially portentous moment is the following. The post-war economic boom that we lived through solved a lot of problems by virtue of the boom. Not all the ships were rising, but a lot of them were. And the economic boom permitted people to say, well, you don't have to do anything but ride the boom. That was a temporary moment. We now know that. Some of you hear about this new book by Piketty. It's on capital, big, big, big study of capital. He reached the conclusion that many of us have reached, that moment was an aberration. Highly unusual moment, had to do with, in part, Germany, Japan, Britain, France were devastated by the war, and we swept in, and our economy boomed until they returned. You know, when they returned, there was a different competition. Partly that, partly there were savings in World War II that fueled the boom. People that made a lot of money during the war had put it in savings, and after the war they bought houses and cars and the economy boomed. The labor unions were strong. Why? Partly because World War II strengthened labor unions, and they could demand higher wages until they were beaten down. But the point to note, and we could go at length into this, I talked about it a bit in my book, that was a brief, aberrant moment that we took for granted. And we thought that was the future. The other brief, aberrant moment, and it was really weird, is the period from 1929 to 1945. There was a collapse, the Great Depression. Now, if there had been a Democratic president happened to be in office rather than Herbert Hoover, some very different politics might have happened. So we got lucky. There was a Republican conservative, and he got the blame, and the New Deal came in an aberrant moment called the Great Depression. And we got Social Security, and we got some programs, many, many programs came out of that, and the labor movement was strengthened. And then World War II, now here's a way to think, here's how historians think, World War II is a really unusual thing historically. You don't have vast world wars all the time, and indeed you probably will never have them again because of nuclear weapons. We may blow ourselves up, but we're not probably going to see, you know, millions of men marching in tanks and guns across that land wars that organize the whole economy and then build a new economic system, war system in the United States. That was a very odd moment. Historians are beginning to say those two periods that most people take for granted, the New Deal and World War II, which built one era of booming economy, and then the post-war boom when the opposition was all devastated, those were very strange moments. What we are now entering looks not only like the 1920s, it looks like the period from the beginning of the century, that 20th century, in which stalemate and stagnation, that's the big word in economics now, stagnation and decay, are the rule, not the exception. I could give you a long discussion that you don't want to hear about, but if you begin to understand, or possibly understand, and more economists have now reached this point, Paul Krugman is now saying, we're into an era of long-term stagnation. Piketty, who's the new rage, we are into a period of long-term stagnation. Even Larry Summers, we are into a period of long-term stagnation. Rather than the cheery language, we're going to boom and it's going to be fine, don't worry. That is a new understanding, and it is very relevant to our movement. Because if it is the case that pain is going to grow, and it is growing, that's why these things are popping up. If it is the case that it's not going to be solved by electing the next Democrat, and it is not going to be solved by electing the next Democrat, the power of that movement out of which I came was the power of liberalism, supported by great labor union structures that now are, they were 34% of the labor force organized, they're down to 11%, 6% in the private sector. That's over. A lot of pain going to come out of that. But also growing awareness in the new era we're entering that either we move in a different direction or it gets worse. That's, I think, the heart of what is occurring. Now, the positive side about that, and there is a positive side, remember, I think of it as a historian, and I urge you to think of it that way, is that as that sinks in, we are beginning to see people develop new strategies out of pain and out of frustration, out of anger and out of hope. That's what we're seeing out in the country that isn't being reported. That's what you guys are doing when you see the work co-ops developing. What you see, I was just at Red Emma's, and it's beautiful, the development over the last 8 years of that organization. And what you're doing here, reaching the level of now we've got to take this whole thing to a different level with organizing and changing. That process, difficult, painful, first changing awareness, but also changing developmental strategies, and beginning to think not abstractly, but very concretely, what would it actually mean if we were to take ourselves really seriously, and to say that we together are in the process of building a movement to transform the most powerful political economic system in the history of the world. Not rhetorically. I mean, really. Now, what I heard you guys before I got up here to talk, and you know, what free talk is about, what don't bother, is that's what you're doing. What I see you doing is in the process of saying, hey, we've got to do something different in the way of organizing. We've got to change what we're about. And we've got to be part of a national movement that may be the 20 states, Vermont first, and maybe we'll be second or third or fourth, and join with others in this state and around the country who are doing worker co-ops and land trusts and green part. There's a whole green part of this as well. There's an ecological movement that's part of this new economy development, whatever is emerging. That this is a process. It's a very normal process. Very ordinary. Very heroic, but very ordinary, that when things get worse, people either wake up and say, nobody else can do this but us. Who, me? Who else? Look in the mirror in the morning. I suggest this to you, learned this from a radical organizer once. You just look in the mirror in the morning and say, who, me? Who else? So, that's part of the sermon. I'd get away from that part of it. The reason I think this is the most interesting period in American history that we happen to be living into, I've given you some sketch, that the era we're entering is saying the old ways really don't work. We got away with it with the boom, and we got away with it with the depression, and something aberrant happened, but we are now entering a period where it's probably no easy way, kind of getting in the way of the fact that either you develop something new and change the system, or it gets worse. Now, as you may have noticed, I'm talking about changing the system in a kind of different way than some people talk about it. I'm talking about it in a kind of, what I think of as an American kind of emergent form. There's a whole Marxist theory that the system has to collapse and there'll be a revolution. I don't think that's going to happen. I think it's going to stagnate and decay. And besides, if there was a great collapse, it'd probably go to the right rather than the left. So I don't think that's right. And I don't think we're going to get a liberal solution of the kind that I used to run House and Senate staffs on. Labor movements all over the world have collapsed, and that was the heart of that movement. What I think we're into is a different process. And we have to, I have a name for it, but we need a better name. It's one in which there's growing awareness, but also growing development, and an evolving, changing transformation, including transforming how the ownership of the system is structured. In this case, single payer is one form of it. The worker co-ops in Cleveland are another form of it. The land trusts are another form of it. The municipal ownership is another form of it. It is a pluralist form of evolving, an evolutionary transformation that also challenges as it goes. We'll see. That's a possibility. That's, you know, something you may or may not want to bet your life on. That is what the process of organizing is about. But that's the kind of process that may set us up step by step for a larger change at some point. I'm going to say two or three more words. Don't trust me if I say that, because I probably say a little more. But two or three more things that at least give me perspective on it, the way I think about it. You know, the way the American system, and now I speak as a historian, and some other historians will challenge me for sure, the way the American system was run successfully in the 19th century was pretty simple. You had an empty continent, except for all those people who lived here, and you had a lot of fertile land. None of the other countries had that, by the way. Just think about that. Very unusual, extremely unusual. And when you got into trouble with the economic system, all you had to do is kind of take more land and kick the people off. You could do that for a whole century. And then till you got to the Pacific Ocean, and that was, you know, then you got a little new problem. So just a shorthand way of saying they ran the system by taking over the continent, step by step, when they got into trouble. In the 20th century, all too simple, every time you got into trouble, you solved the problem with a war. I don't mean they created wars to solve the problem. I don't think that's true. I don't believe in conspiracies. But World War I did, in fact, solve the problem in a major recession, and World War II pulled us out of the Depression, and the post-war boom was the Korean War, the Cold War, Vietnam War, et cetera, and stabilized the economy. We're running out of war, and that's a good thing. We're not going to solve the problems. And the military budget, large as it is down to 4-3% of the economy. It's going down further. It's in that range now. So we're not solving the problems by taking land, and we're not solving the problems by going to big wars like a continental war. which means that the issues are going to deepen right before us because the traditional solutions aren't available. That's a really interesting part of history. That's a period when disillusionment grows slowly, and people beating a lot of right-wing stuff too, begin to say either something different is going to happen or it gets worse. And either we do something different or it gets worse. Or either I do something different, go in this direction. But when I hear what you folks are beginning to struggle with, and the healthcare system is 20% of the 18% of the GDP, it is a big component of it. Taking that on directly as you are doing seems to me a central piece of what has to be done and what can be done if you say, where are we going over the next decade or two and how do we organize with other parts of this movement that is moving in the same kind of chaotic, slow-reaching conclusions in different parts of the economy, that something has to happen that is not trying to regulate, not trying to just pass bills, but changes actually in a democratic form who gets to own this stuff. That, I think, is the possibility that's right before us in this era and at this time. So I'll say one more thing and then I'll sit down. You've probably had enough of this. The one way I think about it, and my heroes, and I happened to work a little bit with Dr. King when I was younger, much younger, and I was a great admirer of what they did, and what he did, and also what the SNCC people did. And a lot of people did different things in the civil rights movement. Probably a lot here know about that. But my heroes are not the civil rights workers of the 1960s. They are my heroes, but the ones I really take my hat off to, and think about this, they're the people in Mississippi in the 1930s and 40s who laid the groundwork when it was really hard to do, upon which the successful civil rights movement built, and without which they could not have built. Those are the ones, and you know, facing murder, facing being killed, all the terrible things, but those were the people who actually established the conditions in a very hard time. And the same thing is true of the women's movement and the environmental movement. If you actually look in the prehistory of what we call the movements, it's very easy to join a movement when the movement's moving. That's no problem. Hey, that's fun, actually. You have a lot of fun. The real work is laying the groundwork for the transformative possibility that comes thereafter. And from what I've heard here, that's what I think you guys are trying to do, and that's why this is the place I want to be. Thank you very much. Local. I think the local aspect is critical because it's where people actually learn really what this is about, and it's not abstract. But, you know, there are these big corporations, too. And by the way, did you notice we nationalized General Motors and we nationalized Chrysler? We nationalized de facto the biggest insurance company, AIG, in the world, and we nationalized five big banks? We did do that. And we gave them, after pouring a lot of money in, we gave them back to the private owners. But, you know, maybe the next time if we build the base, and the next time, or the one after that, we'll begin actually to say we can take on some of the big ones as well. That's what a movement is about, getting to the place where you can actually ask the question you're asking, but in a very clear way. The system is generating crisis at that level as well. We've just seen it, and every major specialist in the banking industry predicts another big crisis in the next 3 to 5 years because you can't regulate them. They know better than you know that they cannot be regulated. So they're going to come down again. And you know, the current nostrum on banking, and just let me digress. The current nostrum, because they all predict there'll be another crisis. So when the next crisis happens, the liberal solution, which I think we're going to go through, and I think it's better than not having a solution, break them up. Make them into little banks. And then, of course, they're going to regroup. The big fish will eat the little fish and will be back at the trough. That's what the conservatives understood. That there is no answer but public ownership for some of the big ones, because you can't regulate them, and if you break them up, they regroup. So I think that, you know, to say that is you throw 30 years on the table. But I think that's the process we're likely to see in several of them. And I'm certain, if I had to predict one thing, I think we're going to see more crises because they can't manage the system. And it's a very odd crisis because it doesn't collapse all the way because the government, I should have mentioned this. The reason it doesn't collapse all the way is because in 1929, the government was 11% of the GDP. It's now 33% of the GDP. It will go down, but not collapse. And so you get this strange stagnation decay, which is much easier, better context for organizing. But the big ones, I think, are in the picture. The question is the Affordable Care Act a step forward to single payer, or is it a step back? So Margaret has much better view of this than I do, but here's what I think it has.
Where we can take the Affordable Care Act and tinker with it a little bit and patch it up a little bit, and we're going to make it into a universal publicly financed system. Overall, what the Affordable Care Act is, it moves us farther on the spectrum towards privatization of our health care. We're seeing tremendous government subsidies going right into the private insurance industry. We're seeing privatization of our public insurances, Medicaid and Medicare. We're seeing a lowering of the bar of what's considered to be acceptable coverage. And we're seeing a tremendous consolidation of the providers. The health insurance companies are now eating up all of the providers, as you know, or starting to eat into the providers as well. So this is in the spectrum taking us more towards privatization. What it's an opportunity for that's not happening in the public sphere enough, because we're talking about how many people got insurance or enrolled and not the real issues of what did they get. Do they get access to care? Are they going to go bankrupt if they get an illness? Are our health outcomes going to improve? What we really need to be talking about is, do we want to go in that direction? Do we want to continue to treat healthcare as a commodity so people only get as much healthcare as they can afford? Or is that the wrong direction and we need to head this way and treat healthcare as a public good like every other industrialized nation does and create a healthcare system, a single-payer system that achieves that? So I think we've got to insert that. There's all this distraction going on, focusing on the numbers. We've got to cut right through that.
I don't favor it. He's pointed out that the civil rights, I'm exaggerating, the civil rights movement was it was an economic failure. That is to say, the poverty levels are like the ones I talked about in Cleveland, all over the country. So was apartheid. We broke down apartheid, but if you look at the economy, it's dreadful. And we haven't, so that's number one. Number two, he said that he disagrees with me about the military budget, that the military budget's a great waste. There's a slight, we should talk about that, I think it is too. And spent a lot of time working and writing about that, but that we need to talk more about it. And third, we need to talk more about climate change. Okay. So, I am suggesting to you, I don't think we differ on the nature of the problem. That's where Martin Luther King reached that point at the end of his life, and came to essentially a socialist solution. There was no doubt about that. Now we have lots of documentation. He understood that you couldn't get there from here unless you transformed the system. Now, you'd be frightened to say that publicly because it would hurt the civil rights movement, etc. But we are at the point where either you begin looking towards systemic change if you want to deal with poverty and inequality, or it gets worse. I was trying to say that in a different way. And one of the things we're seeing is experimentation with transforming who gets to own capital. And it is a process. Either there are three ways to talk about this. We'll elect a good liberal and he will pass a bill and it'll be over. Or there will be a revolution and the problem will be solved. Or we will build up a whole movement steadily from the bottom up that begins to transform not only systems at the local level, but ideas about what a transforming system is that will reach a point where we can then build a politics with that. And I'm suggesting that that's where we are now. People are beginning to say we must change how this thing is owned and developed piece by piece in the communities in which they live, or it gets worse. So we may or may not differ, but that's the argument here, and it's really good to clarify it in terms of you want to deal with inequality, you want to deal with poverty, either you transform ownership and do it in a way that is built from the bottom up rather than some top-down thing and begin to transform ideas and experience and vision from real things on the ground, or which means that the pain levels are going to grow. So even though it is wasteful, and large, relative to this gigantic economy, it is not sufficient to solve the problems as it did in the post-Cold War period, in the Vietnam era, when it was 7, 8, in fact 14% during the Korean War, 10% during the 1950s, 8.8% during the 1960s, 7.7% of the GDP in the 1970s, and now moving towards 2 and 3. It doesn't have the economic capacity to solve the economic problem. Wasteful as it is, that means the problem will get worse and the organizing context is going to be much more open because of the pain levels. I totally agree with you. We haven't talked about the environment, and I'm sorry I didn't spend time on that, but I totally agree we should spend more time on that. And if you read my book, you'll see there's a lot about it in that. There are legal obstacles to establishing these kind of local forms of changing ownership rather than the national or state. In most parts of the country, there is a long tradition of co-ops, mostly agricultural co-ops, that gives you a very leg up on these kinds of things. So we have, and it's happening in many parts of the country, we have seen, there's an interesting phenomenon, young lawyers are beginning to get into this, because co-ops in the country were mainly agricultural. And now they're beginning to say, how do we adapt this experience and these existing laws that the farmers built up that can be used for other kinds of co-ops? Land trust is wide open. That's not a, it's, it can be done, but it's an organizing problem to get it happening. Most of these things are doable. All it takes is, what Terry was saying earlier, all it takes is organizing and get to work, you know. That's where the action is. Organizing to make it happen is the challenge, which means that the problem comes right back to roost in the seat in which we all sit. And in the process, learn principles to take to the higher level as well. I mean, the other piece about this, state banking is now hot. 20 states have introduced legislation to establish public banks like the existing Bank of North Dakota, which has been there 100 years. Every sector you look in, there's a lot of action building on. So let me say something about credit unions, because I don't want any illusions. As soon as you're going to do what she and I want to do, they're not going to like it. And we're seeing this around the country. Just so you know, because you're going to twist the cat's tail and the cat's going to bite. This happened in Vermont. In Vermont, they tried to do this, and they're still there. They've elected a couple of people to the board, but all of a sudden, the board meeting gets shifted to Sunday morning at 7 in the morning, and nobody's told. Annual meeting. Oh, nobody's here. You guys, that's one thing happens. And the group at the Democracy Collaborative is trying to do this with a Lafayette Credit Union, which is a Maryland union. It's a credit union. So two of the guys got 200 people to sign a petition to get them on the ballot to be members of the board. All of a sudden, this is a credit union, democratic organization in Maryland. They moved the annual meeting. You're going to have a little bit of a challenge. Nonetheless, it is a one-person, one-vote bank, and you are a member, and if you want to do it, it's what Sergio was talking about. You got to just do it. It's not easy, but that's the challenge. Question. That's a great question, because she said, how does the democratization of wealth translate into political power, like in Cleveland? And that's a really good question, because these are institutional developments, changing ownership, and they're not necessarily political. They could be. They could be a base for real politics. Jackson Rising in Mississippi. Here's what we're seeing, and again, the press just doesn't cover it. You see people doing experiments that are just changing ownership. It's a good thing to do. And then somebody else says, your question. So in Cincinnati, the Cleveland model, which is not very political, it's really interesting structurally, but it's not very political. In Cincinnati, the unions got together with a number of organizers, and it's got a political thrust. And in Jackson, Mississippi, they're taking it to a whole political level. The mayor, unfortunately, died, but his son's running, and there's a whole movement to try to turn it right into politics and use the power of city government to help. So I'm cautiously optimistic that learning curve, which starts with basically counter-institutions of, hey, you can do it, and then begins to say, how do we use political power to aid and turn it into a political process too, begins to develop. And at least we're seeing that around the country. And if we don't see it, you've got to make it happen. We've got to make it happen. I agree with that entirely. But don't underestimate the importance of the models, because they begin to give people some idea of what can be done. Vermont is showing you what can be done, and then it tells you you've got to do politics to make it happen here. And that's the same thing we're seeing all around. Models are important, but they don't stand unless you do policy. Yes, how do you get capital to start these things? Land trust or co-op, et cetera. And the answer is catch-as-catch-can. Industry collapse. It was in 1977 in Youngstown. 5,000 guys lost their job in one day. That was really big news, front page news all over the country. It's not news anymore because it happens all the time. So the steelworkers and the local ecumenical coalition say, this town's going to really go down. We should take over the mill. And they start organizing to do that. And I was called in to try to help because I was a, quote, economist who was interested in worker ownership. So, and they built a whole model, and they came up with the Carter administration financed for sophisticated study, et cetera. They got the national churches. They really built a whole movement. They got the Carter administration promised $200 million in loan guarantees. Bob Embry, who was the president of the local Able Foundation, was an assistant secretary of HUD, and he financed it at those days, how to do worker ownership in 1977. Okay, so they got right down to the line, and then after the election of 78, the money disappeared. And why it disappeared is because the big corporations and almost certainly the big steel workers union went to the White House and said, don't do that. Neither one of them. The interesting part about that, but they kept organizing. And in Ohio, you find lots of worker-owned companies because they understood you keep organizing anyway, and the stuff in Cleveland really flows out of this. The people were inspired by Youngstown, or actually some of the people who did it in Cleveland. Think about decades and think about historical change and the process over time. They lost, but they won in some sense. Here's the interesting thing. The International Steelworkers Union cut the throats of the local steelworkers. They didn't want those guys in worker ownership, and they didn't want these activists in the union because it might challenge the leadership. So they were against the local worker ownership structure. That was 1977. Steelworkers today are the biggest union supporting worker-owned co-ops in the country. There has been a transformation also in the unions, and there's a transformation also in the organizers in Ohio. So if you think about that process of development, rather than how to, you know, lose one, we win, yeah, you lose one, we win one, lose one. That's the process over time in an era of stalemate, stagnation, and pain.
UWEPR, United Workers End Poverty Radio.